From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. A trial that some say could cripple Nevada's ability to regulate water within the state begins today, June 8th, in a Las Vegas courtroom. For decades now, developers and the state have gone back and forth over Coyote Springs. That's a development about an hour northeast of Las Vegas. No one lives there, and that's largely because the state engineer years ago declared that there wasn't enough water. That decision was backed by the Nevada Supreme Court. Now, those developers say they're entitled to restitution for all the money they sank into the project. They claim the state essentially stole their water rights. The lawsuit could potentially cost the state billions. Alan Halaly has been covering it all for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. He shared this update. Alan, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For those who are not familiar, let's start this conversation with talking about Coyote Springs. Where did this idea for this town in the middle of nowhere north of Vegas come from?
Well, the original idea was to build some sort of a satellite city to the Las Vegas Valley, where there would be almost 100,000 homes and all these amenities, resort casinos, golf courses. That would, you know, essentially be to Las Vegas what Scottsdale is to Phoenix. You know, there was a lobbyist named Harvey Whittemore in the 90s who bought this land with the intention of doing that. But there was one problem, and the problem was water, as it often is in Nevada. And there's been decades of back and forth with the state engineer is in charge of administering water rights in all of Nevada's hydrographic basins. And eventually, they made the decision that there was not enough groundwater to build what they had wanted to build in Coyote Springs. It went all the way to the Nevada Supreme Court, where the Nevada Supreme Court said that, you know, the state engineer did act appropriately in kind of treating this whole area as its own one big basin. It's, you know, the headwaters of the Muddy River are where the Moapa Dace live, which is a very tiny fish that they were concerned about if those springs ended up drying up. So all this to say, you know, there wasn't enough water and, you know, we're still feeling the ripple effects of that with this lawsuit that is going to trial.
Now, that Supreme Court decision was in 2024, correct?
It was.
So this has been in litigation for years. So what is this, I guess, new lawsuit? You know, what is the new wrinkle here?
Right. Well, I think in speaking with the attorneys on this case, there was this idea that under what they call the Takings Clause of the Nevada Constitution, that the water rights associated with Coyote Springs were, quote, taken by the state. And basically what that means is, if it is determined that these water rights were indeed property that were taken by the state, that they need to be compensated for it. So this is a lawsuit dating back to 2020 that had been put on pause while this was being, you know, litigated at the Supreme Court, but it survived. And now, you know, the state is potentially looking down the barrel of paying billions of dollars in a settlement for essentially administering water rights, as the state engineer is tasked with doing. So this has survived all of this, and I think that's been a surprise to some people. And it's kind of the final act. And, you know, speaking with the attorneys on the developer side, you know, they kind of feel that if Nevada wants to do everything it can, pull out all the stops to stop this development from happening, they deserve something in return for putting hundreds of millions of dollars into this property, developing water rights. As you can imagine, it's been very expensive for them. But the larger question is, you know, whether the state engineer will hesitate when doing things like this in the future, if this does prevail. And, you know, the state, as you know, doesn't have a lot of extra money to be doling out billions of dollars to developers who are mad about water rights.
So where does the governor's office come into all of this?
Well, the governor's office comes in with Mark Hutchison, who Governor Lombardo has close ties to. Mark Hutchison is the former lieutenant governor, a big GOP mega donor behind many super PACs in Nevada that have contributed millions to both of his campaigns. And Hutchison is also the lead attorney for the Sinos, the developers of Coyote Springs, since about October. So there's that aspect of it, as well as, you know, the new state engineer that was appointed in February following the firing of Adam Sullivan, who was the namesake of that 2024 Supreme Court case. This new state engineer, Joe Cacioppo, who was appointed in February, he left his job at a water rights consulting firm, which has ties to Coyote Springs and still does. So there are questions just about this engineer who very closely worked with the state engineer's office in the past on behalf of mining and developers, how that looks in the future and whether, you know, those decisions will be made in favor of these folks that are kind of responsible in many ways for the decline of our basins.
So talk to me about this trial. You know, what should people who have been following this case, what should they expect over the next couple of weeks?
Right. So this trial is expected to last months. And the way it works is, you know, there is no jury at the outset of it. And it will be decided by Judge Mark Denton as to whether this should go to a jury. And if that does happen, the jury would be tasked with deciding exactly how much to give the developer on behalf of the state. I've heard that there's probably about 30 trial days, and not every day of the week is a trial day in district court. So we could be seeing this play out for multiple months. All eyes will be on whether, you know, Denton decides that this should move forward to a jury. And it'll be interesting to see if that jury decides, if at all, there is a settlement here for the Coyote Springs folks.
Alan Haleli is the environmental and water reporter for the Las Vegas Review Journal. Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
Many tribal communities do not have running water. A new proposal could fix that with federal law, and it has widespread support. But a few states are standing in the way. For the Mount West News Bureau, partner station KJZZ in Arizona teamed up with ProPublica to find out why. Here's Alex Hager.
In most American homes, getting water in your kitchen sink is as easy as flipping on the faucet, but not here. Marilyn Tiwa gets all of hers at this rickety windmill, which pulls untreated water from a well underneath this dusty, windy plain.
It's a daily thing for us out here to do this, and, you know, other people just don't realize what we go through.
This is life on the Hopi Reservation. Tiwa is a member of the tribal council and still lives in the village she grew up in, atop a rocky mesa with endless views of the desert. Today, just like back then, water comes to the house in buckets.
We don't have any indoor plumbing, so we have to, you know, rely on outside porta-johns. So I hope that one day we'll be able to have all of these facilities that other people have in their homes.
For the Hopi and two other tribes in the area, those hopes could soon become a reality, thanks to the proposed Northeastern Arizona Indian Water Rights Settlement Act. If it passes, Navajo Council Speaker Crystalyn Curley says the results could be life-changing.
For me, it's not about green grass lawns or golf courses or swimming pools. You know, it's just basically turning on a faucet and getting water to boil eggs for your children.
The settlement is part of a long and complicated history. The Colorado River supplies water for big cities and farms across the West. Native tribes have legal access to about a quarter of its flow, but lack the money and infrastructure to use it. This is a way for three tribes, Hopi, San Juan Southern Paiute, and Navajo, to change that.
If we're going to operate and run like a nation, we need people that live on the nation, work on the nation, have their kids go to school here.
That's Navajo President Boo Nigrin.
And without water, you can't do any of that stuff. So that's how important water is.
This settlement is a compromise. The tribes would agree to take less water than they might be legally owed. And in return, the government would give the tribes $5 billion. That would fuel the construction of a pipeline that could bring running water to thousands of homes. After years of work, tribal leaders say they're really close to getting it done, but there's a major hurdle standing in the way.
What the settlement is proposing is something new.
That's Heather Tanana, a Navajo citizen and law professor at the University of Denver. She explains it like this. Over a century ago, the states that used the Colorado River were split into two camps. There's the upper basin, Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, and the lower basin, Arizona, California, and Nevada. When it comes to sharing water, they rarely agree, and the Navajo Nation is stuck in the middle.
It straddles three states, and it crosses over, you know, this magical line that was created of the upper basin and the lower basin.
The deal that would give the tribes water and money would also let the Navajo Nation lease some of its water from the upper basin to the lower basin, like fast-growing cities in the Phoenix area that are looking for every drop they can get.
That creates a little fear for some of these upper basin states that if we allow this to happen, what else might happen?
That's the main reason why the tribal water deal hasn't gone through. Because Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming are worried that it would set a precedent for taking their water and sending it downstream. KJZZ and ProPublica reached out to those four states for comment. Water officials pointed to letters they wrote to the Senate. The states wrote that they supported the idea of getting water to the reservations, but still had significant concerns. Colorado wrote that downstream leasing would harm the security and certainty of the state's river access. But at a Senate hearing in March, Navajo President Nygren said worries about a new precedent are unfounded.
There is no way for this to happen again because there is no other tribe besides Navajo in this position.
So now, for people like Marilyn Tiwa who haul buckets of water to homes that don't have showers, sinks, or toilets, all that's left is to wait for a decision from policymakers that could make generational change.
We're at their mercy and, you know, begging for something which we are entitled to. I just hope that somebody up there will listen to us and help us out, that we get this settlement passed.
Tiwa says she's hoping on behalf of her children, her grandchildren, and their children who haven't come yet. Alex Hager, reporting from northeastern Arizona.
Mountain West News Bureau partner KJZZ Radio in Phoenix produced that story along with ProPublica reporter Mark Olalde. You can learn more about what's going on in the Colorado River Basin on our website, knpr.org. June was National Immigrant Heritage Month. President Barack Obama made the proclamation a dozen years ago to honor the diverse experiences and contributions of people who immigrate to America. Historically, Nevada has had a large foreign-born population. It was made up of 44% immigrants just 6 years after being declared an official state, and it maintains a higher-than-average percentage today. But for some of Nevada's roughly 640,000 immigrant residents, this year has lacked a feeling of celebration, and that includes in the month of June. KNPR's Rafael Gandolfo Bustamante spoke with immigrants in the community to bring us more.
Immigrant entrepreneurs represent nearly 27% of business owners in Nevada, and according to the American Immigration Council, they are responsible for $1.5 billion of Nevada's total business income. Yasmin Flores and her husband, Enrique Fuentes, are among those immigrant entrepreneurs. Attached to their car, you'll find their quaint coffee trailer, Tres Niñas Café. The sliding window opens, tunes of Latin music fill the air, and a hand reaches out to serve an ombre beverage of dark espresso blended with milk. As June ends, Flores reckons with feelings of irony the month brought about.
If it reflected us being celebrated, then it'd be different. But the way the laws are going right now, it seems like we all have to be in hiding.
Flores says she's a first-generation American. Her husband immigrated from Mexico in 2005. And they take pride in their heritage. Their cafe on wheels offers what they say is a safe place for people in the community. But over the past year, Flores and Fuentes and their customers have faced challenges, especially with regard to immigration customs and enforcement, they say. As arrests hit an all-time high and fear has surged, Flores has been forced to make tough decisions, like closing up shop.
Even though financially it puts a strain on us, we decide to close because we would hate for something to happen or for somebody to show up, especially when we promote being Mexican and we promote supporting each other.
President Donald Trump did bring attention to immigrants in June, but not as part of the celebration. That includes the Supreme Court upholding his decision to end temporary protected status for Haitian and Syrian immigrants and to turn back asylum seekers at the border. In addition, Trump signed the recently passed Secure America Act on June 10th, giving the Department of Homeland Security's immigration enforcement agencies a total of $70 billion. This means fully funding the agencies through his second term. Here's the president as he signed the bill into law.
And starting on day one of my administration, we took the most dangerous, unsafe, violent, and open border people out of this country. We got them out.
Governor Lombardo was among 22 Republican governors urging Congress to pass the act. In a joint letter, they deemed the funding necessary to protect the nation from what Lombardo called, quote, dangerous criminals, drug traffickers, and human traffickers. In the past year alone, ICE arrests have increased dramatically. Some months had triple the number of average daily arrests compared to a year earlier, according to University of Las Vegas law professor and immigration clinic director Michael Kagan.
There is a basic contradiction that they like to say we're going after the worst of the worst. But like I said, only 3% of the people they're arresting have a conviction for a violent felony. The United States government at the highest levels right now is doing everything possible to tell immigrants, well, you're not wanted.
Kagan says it's led to people living with intense levels of fear and uncertainty about their day-to-day lives. That's how Norma Torres, a housekeeper on the Strip, feels. She's a single mom of four who immigrated from Mexico when she was 11 years old. She's part of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, which allows her a protected status to work in the U.S. Hospitality is a major economic driver in Las Vegas, and immigrants make up nearly one-third of that industry. However, Torres often feels the contribution of immigrants like her goes unrecognized.
If the companies, they don't have like housekeeping or food servers or anything like that, the hotels, they're not like why they are.
Her DACA work authorization must be renewed every 2 years. Recently, however, unexplained federal agency delays are leaving some, and their incomes, at risk.
See, in my case, I had to renew before September of this year. I did it in March and haven't heard anything about it.
The Immigration Service's radio silence has left Torres worried. Losing her job would mean not being able to provide for herself and her children. UNLV's Kagan says these delays have broader effects. He describes them as self-destructive for the economic and social community. However, not all immigrants are concerned about the process changes.
They're coming over here illegal. I'm from Germany. I had to come with papers. I never lived off the government. I worked all my life.
That's Sigrid Odell, a German immigrant who voiced her concerns earlier this month during the primary election. She supports Trump's recent strategies, feeling migrants should go through similar legal channels as she did. Back at Tres Niñas Cafe, Yasmin Flores says immigrant businesses help bring the community together.
I feel like we all support each other enough to feel like we have like that love and support.
In a city as diverse as Las Vegas, reminders of immigrant contributions are around every corner. Flores says that will continue, regardless if that recognition happens in June for National Immigrant Heritage Month or not. Rafaela Gandolfo Bustamante, KNPR News.
Seventy-four data centers are currently in operation or in some phase of construction across the Silver State. That's according to Data Center Map, an online tracker of data center developments worldwide. These facilities have become a necessary part of today's increasingly digitized world. They've also become a flashpoint for many communities. The top concerns? Energy and water consumption. In response, local government officials have taken on efforts to regulate or halt data center construction while they grapple with how best to oversee the burgeoning industry. Environmental advocates recently scored a win in Reno. City officials approved a moratorium on any new data center construction, and since then, other communities have followed suit. To learn more about why Reno voted to hit the pause button on data centers, KNPR's Heidi Kaiser spoke with Reno City Councilperson Naomi Dewar.
Councilmember Dewar, thank you for joining us. The city of Reno's original 30-day moratorium on data centers was extended until August 2027, more than a year from now. Why such a long extension?
Originally, we were contemplating December of 2026. But the concept is that, A, it takes a fairly long time to prepare good regulations. I mean, the staff can crank it out in 30, 60, 90 days, but it often takes longer if we're going to vet those with the public. And the second issue is that the Nevada legislature will be meeting from February to June of 2027. And I've already spoken to a number of legislators. They're planning to take up the issue of data centers. And so we want to make sure that we incorporate the latest, greatest information from the legislature into our ordinance. Since they end around June 1, that would give us 3 more months to refine our ordinances if necessary.
The Nevada Independent and others have reported that you said the council had something like 30 issues that the council needs to address. They cited impacts like noise, air quality effects, fire and building safety. What are the top things to tackle first in your mind?
For me, the number one unresolved issue is the energy question. The reason is, I think all of the issues are very important and they're all virtually unresolved. So that's the whole point of us getting together with our colleagues and others. And let me just go back for a minute. In terms of what the council will be doing, we will be getting periodic updates. I've specifically asked for that for our staff. I said, I don't want to start now and never hear the word data center until they're presenting the ordinance, right? We need to be brought along. So getting to your question about what's the biggest issues, I have said there are as many as 30. That's because there are probably 10 bigger ones and about 20 smaller ones that still have to get worked out. For me, the biggest unresolved issue is energy. Where does it come from? Who's providing it? How does it get from point A to point B? What is fueling the energy? And then are there impacts to individual ratepayers, such as me, such as all of us?
There are data center protests across Nevada. Are you talking to other municipal leaders about how to address this? Do you all work together, or is this something that's just going to happen at the state legislature and then trickle down?
There are two organizations. One is the Nevada League of Cities, and the other is the Nevada Association of Counties. Both of those organizations are talking about data centers. Since we've adopted our moratorium, several counties either have or are poised to adopt a moratorium as well, or they have just point blank turned down data centers. So an example is Boulder City turned down a data center. Another example is Humboldt County enacted a moratorium. Reno was the first, but we're certainly not going to be the last.
And what's the key, in your view, to balancing the economic opportunity that data centers promise with the resource strain and lifestyle effects that your constituents fear?
Abatements will be discussed, I am sure, at the legislature about whether data centers at this point need to be induced to move here through a tax abatement or not. So that question will be have to answered by the legislature. But today, the governor's Office of Economic Development has and probably will continue to offer abatements to data centers. Ultimately, it's very possible that the taxes that these data centers bring could be large. The issue now is that at least for 10 or 20 years, much of it's abated, and meaning we don't get it. And so it's hard to see the economic development if you have very few employees and the taxes are put off. Now, the third arm of this is it takes a lot of people to build these data centers, and it has a very big impact on the construction industry, whether they're doing concrete or electrical or plumbing, whatever trade that they're in, there's a big demand for the skill. The challenge is that once they're built, of course, that demand goes away. For the instant case, people are making money that are in the trades.
That is all we're going to have time for, I'm afraid. Naomi Duer is on the Reno City Council, which recently voted to extend a 30-day moratorium on data centers through next August 2027. Councilmember Duer, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being on.
That was KNPR's Heidi Kaiser speaking with Reno City Councilmember Naomi Duer. And as a personal note of disclosure, my spouse is a City of Reno employee, and therefore I had no hand in the production or editing of that conversation. Of course, Reno is not the only community in Nevada working to develop rules about what kinds of data centers should be allowed to operate within city limits. Just yesterday, July 7th, the Clark County Commission began the process of developing their own rules for data centers. I spoke with Commission Chair Michael Naft and Vice Chair William McCurdy after that meeting to get their thoughts on what they would like to see come out of that process. Chairman Naft, there are currently more than 70 data centers operating in Nevada, the largest concentration of them being in Clark County. What role do you foresee these facilities playing in Southern Nevada's community?
Well, look, I think like anything, you can't take everything and just put it in one bucket. And I think when it comes to data centers, there are certainly those, you know, bad actors who are not supportive of communities, who are a drain on resources, and who are causing real pain points. And then I think there are probably some who have worked closely with community stakeholders over many, many years, and have also worked on different sustainability efforts that have really made them part of the community and even championed by environmentalists and other organizations who all want the best for Southern Nevada in particular, which is our concern. You know, I think that's really what is incumbent on all of us, particularly at local level, to use the levers that are within our control to make sure that things that we are approving from a land use and an entitlement perspective do lift communities up and continue to promote a high quality of life.
When it comes to those good actors and bad actors, I would assume that you would say that Switch is one of those good actors, considering the commission unanimously approved their proposal last month for a nearly 57,000 square foot data center on the corner adjacent to the Switch campus there on Warm Springs Road and Edmund Street.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say that specific project proved to the county under current rules and regulations and policies that are in place that because of their commitment to 100% renewable energy since 2016, because they have followed the law that the county commission put in place requiring evaporative cooling, and because they use a closed loop system, and specifically to that center, they also worked to increase the power consumption, the power availability, not just for themselves, but for that broader township and surrounding area, that they were able to make a compelling case that their land use entitlements should be approved under current and existing law. Does that mean that all data centers can live up to that same high level of scrutiny? No, probably not. And I think that's, sort of the purpose of today was to try and have a dialogue about what we as a community expect from these applicants and perhaps raising that bar a bit.
All right, let's talk about that meeting that happened today or yesterday, July 7th. You all are looking to put regulations into county code to look at them individually versus warehousing. Commissioner McCurdy, what came out of those discussions?
Yeah, so the discussion item was brought forward by Commissioner Sagerbloom, whom after our last meeting where we approved the Switch application, decided that, hey, we need to have a discussion as a board, and that invited out community members to, voice their concerns and also some of the comments that were mentioned at the last meeting. But what I am hoping come out of this is that we are able to direct our staff to get together our stakeholders from around the valley within this particular industry and bring us back some suggestions as to what they found, and which would hopefully allow us to address some of the concerns. But as Commissioner Naft, our chairman, stated, not all applicants are the same, but hopefully after doing a little bit of research by our staff, we'll be able to bring back something to the board that will really set the standard of what our expectations are here in Southern Nevada.
And what would you personally like to see come out of those discussions?
The biggest issue or sets of issues are, water consumption, energy utilization, as well as making sure that the communities in which they're built in and around are respected. So I have a strong feeling towards energy efficiency, strong feeling towards water, conservation, and making sure that the residents that are around the facilities are really comfortable with what's coming in. Because as you all know, we have a really significant issue around water availability in our valley. So we have a responsibility to ensure that we're doing everything that we can, not only to preserve water for us currently here living today, but also for the lives of future generations that's going to grace our valley.
Chairman Naft, opponents of these data centers, including the Toyabe chapter of the Sierra Club, are pushing for a flat-out moratorium like we've seen in other cities like Reno, like Henderson. Would you support a moratorium?
No, I think you have to look at you have to look at the details. Details really matter. And if, I was really pleased that the county worked so closely with the Sierra Club on our update to Title 30 in the last recent years. That's the most significant modernization of a land use and planning code that has really happened in this state for many decades. And in that code, a lot of the things that they're asking for as it relates to data centers are included. In fact, of the items on their sort of wish list, the things that are already in the county's control, many of those things have already been demanded by us. And the things that haven't, we ought to look at and we ought to require. And then I think, as we also spoke about at the commission meeting, there's got to be a unified effort statewide. Commissioner Kirkpatrick spoke about lobbying our legislators to remove the abatements that are currently being offered to these facilities. I think that's an appropriate way to right size what's going on in the community. But also, for In fact, it was one of the commenters during our public comment period at the board meeting who said these companies shouldn't be able to just jurisdiction shop around. You know, if an unincorporated Clark County, we pass some sets of laws, they shouldn't be able to hop on the other side of the street into either the city of Las Vegas, North Las Vegas, or Henderson. And so a regional approach, I think, is something that is appropriate in this regard. And really, a statewide approach, I think, is most beneficial.
Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Rio, Dottie's, Chef Kenny's Vegan Dim Sum, and the congested 215 Beltway, those and so many more Las Vegas landmarks appear in Dangerland, the debut novel by local writer Aaron Singer, and it came out just yesterday. It tells the story of Eugenie and Kurt. They're two middle-aged residents of a Summerlin-like development who maintain a pent-up sexual tension for decades. Making matters worse is a supporting cast of family members, neighbors, and nannies, to say nothing of an ongoing lawsuit that will probably feel pretty familiar to anyone paying attention to local headlines. Singer lives in the Summerlin area herself, and she's here with us today. Erin, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
You've had 24 hours to take it all in. Tell me, what's it like having a book out?
You know, I was a lot more anxious than I thought I'd be. I live a pretty low-stakes suburban life here, taking care of my kids, working a little day job. So it's been wild but fun.
So this fictional lawsuit in this story, it's one of the few obstacles to what might otherwise be a relationship between two romantic leads. It involves a high-end residential community and a golf course. Was the real-life Badlands Golf Club case the genesis for Dangerland?
Absolutely. So I lived in Queens Ridge before and after the golf course got shut down. And it was just what started it was the security company accidentally released everyone's email address. They didn't BCC everyone. They CC'd everyone. So almost immediately, we started getting these crazy emails for and against the development of the golf course. And over time, they seemed to get more and more unhinged. And just the writer in me was like, this is too funny. There was drama, there was comedy, and, you know.
So you were embroiled in it right from the beginning.
Right from the beginning, yeah.
This is not a book of showgirls and blackjack dealers and depraved tourists. The main characters in the book are a developer, a realtor, a failed actor from Los Angeles, a quasi-professional poker player. They're exactly the type of people that we share the roads with every day. So why was it important for you to write about the Las Vegas that locals would recognize versus one that I think a lot of the national audience might come to expect?
Well, for one, I have to be really comfortable to write about a place to feel like I really know it. And I've lived here for 19 years now in the suburbs, and it was just kind of my world. And that's the Vegas I know, and most of us know who live here. It's not the one necessarily on the Strip unless we're going there for work or something. It's just like the, you know, all the Dotties and the taking your kids to, you know, Bonner Elementary for drop-off and all those sorts of things that is the Vegas I know.
You depict a poker game and it's filled with so much poker lingo, and it feels like, you know, I'm watching one of those World Series of Poker tournaments, you know. What's your experience with that?
So my husband is a professional gambler, and we met 2007. I came here for work, and we met at the Rio. I interviewed him. I was working for a poker website, and he invited me out to a barbecue with all these poker players, and it was just a whirlwind sort of romance. And 3 months later, I had moved to Vegas, a place that I was like, I don't even care if I ever visit Vegas. I'm not a gambler. And yeah, now I'm married to a professional gambler, so everything that's in that section was fact-checked by him, or he'd be like, don't say that. That's just embarrassing. You've got to write it this way, or this is how people really speak, so...
You also seem to have a lot of fun exaggerating Las Vegas culture. I mean, have you ever needed a 24-hour pet store?
No, but I was in Henderson, and this was like 10 years ago probably, and I was in a strip mall, and it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I was like, is that a pet store that's open? And I went in there. It was absolute chaos. It was like a weekend night. And this basset hound escaped, and somebody just walked in and was like, I found this dog in the parking lot. I was like, I feel like only in Vegas.
So why are Eugenie and Kurt so chronically platonic, especially in a city known for hookup culture and colorful dating scene?
I think it's just, that's sort of the universal story of when you meet somebody who you really connect with on an emotional level, but then your brain, like on a logical level, is like, this is never going to work. And they really believe that, both of them. As much as they love each other, they can see why this relationship is just not going to work out. And so they sort of commit to never committing to each other. And that just causes chaos in their lives and the lives of, you know, their families, their kids that they have with other people, everything.
The setting aside, is Dangerland a romantic comedy that could take place only here, or could it take place somewhere like Reno, I guess?
That's a good question. I never really thought about it like that. I feel like Kurt and Eugenie are products of Las Vegas because they both grew up here and they both love the city so much. And so the city becomes so important to their love story because Las Vegas, they're both in love with the city. And that's one of the things that they love about each other is that they both, you know, sometimes you meet a lot of people who will kind of drag Vegas for various different things, the negative aspects, and all they see are the positives and the things they love about each other. So the city is a big part of their romance. So that makes it vital to the book.
How long did it take you to write this?
It took me about 5 years, only because when I initially started it, it was a story of 10 different people, and each chapter was told from a different character's point of view. And I submitted it to my agent, and she was just like, Erin, dial it back. This is too many people. So she's like, I really think like the heart of the story is between Eugenie and Kurt here in this romance. And so then I had to kind of go back and really rework the whole book and really focus on that. And it gave the novel a lot more heart, I guess.
What do you think the novel says about relationships and love in 2026 than versus, you know, 2007 when you moved here?
I don't know, because the characters aren't really of the, even for me, like I'm 44, and now people who are in their 20s, how they view relationships is very different from how I see them. And Eugenie and Kurt are in their 50s and Eugenie's 60. And I it's just always evolving. The way people look at relationships is always evolving. Just watch Love Island and you'll see. Wow, times are changing. So in a way, it's a universal story because it's a love story, but it's also, yeah.
You're the second biggest author we've spoken to this summer about a debut novel with the Simon & Schuster company, the other being Krista Diamond. How did you land a deal with such a huge publishing company?
Well, just good luck. The imprint, Summit Books, has been so wonderful. And it just so happened, you know, my agent sent it out to different editors and they really responded to it, everyone at Summit. And I'm just lucky enough to sign with them. And yeah, it's such a huge honor. Simon & Schuster, it's such a cool historic company. And Summit, the imprint, everyone there is amazing. And they were the ones who read it and they were like, you know what? More Vegas. We love this. Give us more. We don't get to see, a lot of books are set in New York and LA, but we don't get to see this sort of suburban side at locals, Las Vegas. So they wanted even more after they read the draft.
Did they actually get all of the Las Vegas nuance from the book, or did you actually have to explain things to them?
Yeah, some things like, you know, how the World Series of Poker or a poker tournament would work, or even just, they were sort of like, could we set this at a more Vegas-y bar? And I'm like, well, if you actually live in suburban Las Vegas, Dottie's is a very Vegas-y, you know, Nevada location. So, you know.
So let me ask, you know, you're originally from Saskatchewan, but you moved here in 2007. Did any culture shock from going from Canada to Las Vegas fuel your writing?
For sure. The character of Nellie in the book is a nanny from Saskatchewan. And I channeled a lot of that into that character because I'm from a really rural northern Saskatchewan place. And I came here and I was like, I felt like I was embedded, like I'm different from everyone. But I look the same and nobody can tell how crazy this is for me, especially because, you know, I went from, you know, my normal rural life to living with a professional gambler who doesn't go to, you know, maybe stays up all night gambling, who has wild hours, wild habits, wild friends. So it was a huge culture shock. I'm still adjusting to it, to be honest with you.
Are you going to be having any local readings?
Yeah, I will be doing an event at the Writer's Block in October. So yeah, if anyone's interested to come and meet me and hear some of the book, you can come then.
We got about a minute left. Let's say the book gets optioned for a film. Who are you casting?
Well, you know, the publicist for Summit Books, who's a huge fan of this book and very enthusiastic and always wants to reach for the stars, was like, I think this is the perfect vehicle for us to see Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt do a movie together or do a TV show together post-divorce. So that's what she's gunning for.
Those are some pretty high hopes.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't say that I'm putting any money on that. Let's just say that. But you know what? If you're going to, you know, dream big, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't have gotten this book published in the first place.
Feels like that might be, you know, part of the story itself. Erin Singer is a Las Vegas-based author. Her just-released debut novel is Dangerland. Erin, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
There's never a shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Back to talk about a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who oversees the arts and culture beat for Nevada Public Radio. Mike, hi.
Hey, Paul.
So it looks like this is a week for the stage.
Yeah, theater heads have a lot of options this week in Las Vegas, but I want to zero in on Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. Now, Paul, you are a history file. What could a title like that possibly portend in your mind?
I think The Trail of Tears springs to mind.
Well, that will be addressed in this musical. I initially thought this might be some kind of Inglourious Bastards-like revision where the indigenous tribes that Jackson violently pushed westward get their revenge on the seventh president. And this is much more ridiculous than that. Here, Andrew Jackson is recast as, get this, an emo rock star. And he uses his catchy songs to spread the word of his brand of populism to get him elected. And this overlaps with the creation of the Democratic Party, albeit one that differs a lot from the one that we have now.
Listen, the parties have changed a lot in just the last 10 years, not to mention the last 200.
Point taken. Now, this is by Majestic Repertory, who is no stranger to A, political theater, as it were, B, satire, and C, building a production around pop music. I should say here that this is not an original Majestic production. This was written by Michael Friedman and Alex Timbers, and it eventually hit Broadway in 2010. But it is directed by Majestic head Troy Hurd, and I bet he had a blast dreaming this up for his intimate venue on Main Street. Now, this one is going to end on Sunday, July 12th, so make note.
So what else can we see on Las Vegas theater stages this week?
Starting on Friday, July 10th, Las Vegas Little Theater is having a go at the Tony-winning production Come From Away. And this is the musical about the plane passengers who were stranded but ultimately welcomed by a small Newfoundland town on September 11, 2001. It's played at the Smith Center before, twice actually, and this will have a more intimate local staging at Las Vegas Little Theater. Also, Ernest Hemmings is doing his comedic performance art, one man does everything show called Test Market. That's on July 11th at the Vegas Theater Company. You probably remember Hemmings describe the verge of chaos nature of this show on State of Nevada earlier this year when he was talking about another production. He calls this work the greatest thing to happen to live theater since sliced Brecht.
Ugh, that's bad.
I kind of love it. A reminder about the works that we talked about last week. What the Constitution Means to Me will be restaged one final time by A Public Fit at July 11th at Windmill Libraries Theater, and 1776 continues at Super Summer Theater through July 18th.
So much political theater, but do you have anything that doesn't require me sitting in an audience?
Well, we have an art exhibition opening at the West Las Vegas Library, and it is a one-man show by multimedia artist Perry Porter. And when I mean multimedia, I mean that Porter is best known for being a painter and a rapper, and both paintings and verses will comprise this show, which is called The Renaissance Man.
Seems like a fitting title.
Yeah, especially because he's also an activist and a teacher. Now, Porter originally hails from the Tacoma, Seattle area, and it was there that he taught himself how to paint with watercolors. He became very heavily involved in the arts community over there. His artistic purpose comes from wanting to depict Black life, often including Black women, in a very positive, vibrant, playful way that counters the traumatic depictions that we usually see in museums.
And how does he do that?
So the Renaissance Man will feature several of his watercolor and acrylic paintings that include colorful flowers and still lives. He's painted some collage-like fantasias. He's got a different take on perspective art that uses three-dimensional bubbles to portray the face of a woman when you stand back to look at it. And then there's this 8-bit rendering of the pop icon Grace Jones that I know more than one exhibit visitor is going to ask to purchase. And the literature for the exhibit promises that you'll be able to hear, quote, the rhythm of lived experience, end quote, of the paintings, which I bet is where his verses come into play. Now, that opening reception is Tuesday, July 14th at 5:30 p.m., and the exhibit will be up until September 22nd.
Lots to explore there. That is all the time we have for this week. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Paul.